the recycling of funds and the need for balances and all that. But for many developing countries in South America, in Africa, and of course in the Philippines, the issues are far sharper than that and more in a way with serious implications. In the case of the Philippines, although our president had indicated we will honor all our debts, yet the problem is there is a net outflow of funds. We service in the neighborhood of about $3 billion a year, interest payments and principal. And the net inflow from borrowings, bilaterals, and official aid will probably be about 1.5. So there's a net outflow of 1.5 billion every year, unless we're able to come up with some schemes that one, will reduce our stock of debts, two, will limit interest payments, three, will allow for a greater inflow of funds. And the implications are quite serious. Unless we meet our growth objectives, then the level of poverty remains high. The level of unemployment remains high. And in the final analysis, our ability to service our debts will be put in question. So that for many developing countries, this is the question: how do we search out for ways of addressing the problem? Of course, we have witnessed some new innovative schemes and the willingness to a limited extent of some governments to come in. For the first time, the U.S. government has participated with a zero coupon bond in the Mexican transaction. There are a lot of what they refer to as menus or options which are market-oriented. But it would appear up till now there is a great reluctance to take hold of the problem in its entirety. And the one, for example, suggestion by the chairman of American Express for a global kind of approach was immediately shut down by Secretary Baker as not being feasible nor practical, even before it had been allowed to be debated upon in the financial circles. And I think the dilemma that will face many developing countries is precisely whether or not within the next decade we are able to ensure that the reverse outflow of funds will in fact be limited and will allow sufficient funding for development. And the whole question of whether the financial system is able to sustain the kind of growth developing countries will need to feed its population is in serious question. And while there are inroads and some limited solutions being found as a whole, many of us in developing countries feel that what is there will not solve the problem. It's just the burden has become too heavy, and we will not be able to survive this for many. Of course, in the case of the Philippines, our recovery has begun, our growth is beginning to take place. There are structural adjustment programs that are being undertaken, and fortunately, it coincides with many of the prescriptions by both IMF, World Bank, Secretary Baker, and others. And while we see in ourselves the capability of moving ahead in line with those programs, there are other countries in South America and Africa which perhaps will continue to face the future in a very bleak manner. So this is part of the whole question, I think, before us.
Thank you, sir. I think you have summed up the challenge which lies ahead of us very accurately. And just to remind you, Australia also is a very heavily indebted country, and at the moment approximately 20% of our export income is required only to pay the interest on our overseas debt. Are there any other comments or questions from the floor before we adjourn?
My name It's Richard Bush from the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. And I'd like to congratulate Mr. Ishiguro for his presentation on internationalisation in Japan and link that with what was said about the problems of the debt, the indebted nations and the difficulties they have in finding markets for their products. And I'd like to hear his comments on the progress being made in Japan to accepting more imports. Japan being one of the major surplus countries in the world, if that surplus can be reduced in some way or at a faster rate, then clearly opportunities will emerge for indebted countries and help solve their debt payment problems.
I think this problem through mechanism, economic mechanism now, I think it can be solved, but at the moment perhaps it depends heavily how United States would perform. Our surplus to United States has been decreasing. So from that point of view, it may still take time, but it's decreasing and it's obvious. But the problem is that this reduction of surplus is being replaced by other countries. So problem of the United States is still there. And as long as yen stays a strong currency, and of course our people, our industry, he would make effort to keep up profit and do our best, and sometimes the situation becomes even worse. But I believe yen can't be appreciated forever. And to my mind, I think it quite over-appreciated. If you think what you can buy with 10,000 yen in Japan and $100 here, you can buy a lot more here. And if you think Japan is vulnerable with energy and raw materials, and in 1990s, probably, if Japan opened up import for agriculture product, then agriculture would become another Achilles to Japan. Now, with these vulnerability factors, I think sooner or later this surplus would adjust it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ishiguro. Ladies and gentlemen, we've run out of time, so we'll now adjourn for the afternoon tea break, and we will resume at 3:50, 10 minutes to 4. Thank you very much. Before we adjourn, I should, since Mr. Bailey... Australian Commercial Life. He's Deputy Chairman of the Totalisator Agency Board in Victoria. He's the Chairman and Managing Director of Florsheim Australia Limited and a member of the board of Florsheim's company in Chicago. and also the Director and Chief Executive of Florsheim Pacific Limited in Hong Kong. And as I'm familiar with the competition which exists in banking, I think it's fascinating to have someone from Florsheim sitting alongside someone from Barter on the same platform this afternoon. He's also President of the Australian Organisation for Assisi Farm Projects, which is an overseas cattle aid project. He's a past president of the Rotary Club of Melbourne, a past chairman of the Footwear Manufacturers Association of Australia, and he has also represented Australia at ILO discussions in Geneva. Barry's a very experienced executive in doing business in the Western Pacific and claims to have 30 years' experience, so he's well qualified to talk to us this afternoon. It's now my pleasure to introduce to you Barry Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Friends, at the outset, let me say why we developed this segment of the Congress on the people issues, or my view as to why we did, and related value systems involved in the operations of regional business ventures, especially those undertaken, from my point of view, by transnational corporations, and my own experience over those years in Asia and with aid programs in the West Pacific Basin region, the area bounded by Japan to Australia, India to the Philippines. I'm bringing to account some of those ideas and views that I formed during that experience. In 1985, I'd like to refer to something that was a hallmark for me and the senior business executive group of the Interchurch Trade and Industry Mission. We had one of those rare opportunities then to present our views to the 10 leaders of Australian churches on a document that some of them had published jointly by, I think it was about five of those churches, entitled, as I recall it, Changing Australia. We as business leaders felt that we should provide other arguments relating to the nature of trends in Australian society and balance the arguments in the document by analysing the major contribution by business to our growth and prosperity. Subsequently, a book, Creating Commonwealth, copies of which are available out there. I don't get a commission on them, but Ian Hall Lacey is the author, was a member of our group. And that book was put out at that time because we wanted to express some other views to those in the document Changing Australia. In the review of that book by Senator Fred Cheney, leader of the opposition in the Senate, and Senator Button's opposite number, as Shadow Minister for Industry, Technology and Commerce, said the book Creating Commonwealth explains why there must be a prior commitment to understanding the nature of wealth, and that's been given a lot of discussion this morning and this afternoon. Failure to understand can leave us all poorer by interfering with the processes of wealth creation on which all charity, public and private, depends. It will be useful to those ordinary Christians who are increasingly puzzled by the hostility shown towards the traditional capitalist ethic, said Fred Cheney. The book's arguments endeavour to indicate approaches responsible Christian business leaders could develop to help the economically deprived and needy members of our community. One conclusion suggests that while few would disagree with the proposition that economic wealth must be created before it is distributed, the economic linkages and basis of wealth creation itself are not well understood. And the discussion throughout the day has indicated that. It is my belief that all sections of the community, men and women of every area of our nation, be they from business, government, church or society, should endeavour to provide the opportunity for all to seek their goal, the ultimate true fulfilment and satisfaction from their lives. We as business leaders can develop creative strategies to help in a positive way those who have difficulty in recognising and achieving their ultimate goal of peace and contentment. And we also believe that transnational organisations and corporations have a very special and vital role in this process, particularly in the developing nations of the world where so many of the poor live. In essence, I am putting to you the fundamental theme of this Congress. I strongly support the view that transnational business leaders have a social responsibility and, in fact, have many opportunities to personally exercise that responsibility. especially in relation to human resource development programs, which again has been mentioned earlier. These programs are an essential part of the task of any new investment, especially in developing nations, and they allow people who gain employment as a consequence of profitable investment to achieve their ultimate goal, personal goals of fulfillment and satisfaction, by gaining recognition for their special, each and every person's special and unique contribution to the corporation. I would like now to turn to my particular experiences to indicate and demonstrate how some of these principles apply and some of the other principles that have been discussed throughout the morning and early afternoon sessions in the operation of the particular transnational corporation I'm involved with, mentioned earlier, the Florsheim Shoe Company based in Chicago, a division of a corporation of $3 billion a year US turnover. Our division does about $1 billion. So it's quite a large company that manufactures, wholesales and retails quality men's and women's footwear in North America and the West Pacific Basin, but not as yet in Japan or Europe, and that's coming, as well as drawing supplies of footwear from South America and Europe. I will also refer to my own personal involvement in aid programs in the Asian region. I'm sorry that the organisation of the conference didn't allow me to produce slides. You'll just have to imagine the words, creating word pictures for you. In the early 70s, having identified the concept of the need for quality consumer goods to be made in the Asian region, I, together with another key executive in the USA, encouraged our international board to establish closer connections with industrialists who are already supplying us with limited quantities of the basic raw materials, such as a range of leathers, kid leathers, long-haired sheep, buffalo leathers. We decided that our first responsibility was to encourage the production of raw materials to a standard that was acceptable for consumers in Western markets. In 1974, we commenced training people living near the tanneries 100 miles west of Madras to make uppers. They were used to complete footwear in our North American and Australian factories where we attached the bottom part of the shoe. This upper program, the first stage in the world shoe concept, led to the establishment of a joint venture with one of the key tanning firms, and a company called Florind, obviously Florsheim India, was established to make a limited range of completed shoes. The success of our new venture in India depended to a large extent upon our training programs, although in the initial stages we found these programs were not as effective as they could have been, and as a result, unfortunately, the progress in the early years in obtaining the quality we wanted was not as we'd originally planned. Since that time, however, we have substantially increased our investment in human resource development programs at both the technical and managerial levels. And I might add that in Australia, we have used the resources of the Shoe and Allied Trade Research Association in the United Kingdom, of which we're a member, which is a specialist in technical and managerial training in the shoe and leather industries. As a result, new training techniques can ensure faster progress can be made in the development of people skills, which are more efficient and satisfying for everyone concerned. And it is interesting that this SATRA organisation, based in the Western world, as a matter of policy, does not make its services available to firms in developing nations. And I, at one of the ILO conferences in 85, and at the first one in 79, but the major one in 85, together with other Australian delegates, and we had a position of influence there, we're all three chairmen of different sectors, opposed this as a matter of justice and asked the ILO to see what they could do about it. However, that's an aside. It shows you discrimination happens sometimes in large institutions and organisations, as they saw their role primarily to help the Western nations against developing nations. And that's written into the text, and that's the sort of problem many developing nations face. Since our involvement in the Indian program, we have employed 3,000 people approximately, either in our joint venture or related companies, and many others have found employment in component and service industries. In the 12 years in India, we've purchased over $400 million worth of products, either as finished leather, uppers, or completed footwear. These shoes from the shoes from these factories are now sold in North America, Australia, and are now being introduced into Asian markets. The quality we feel at this time has reached a level where we find the product, some of the lines especially, are accepted by customers, even in the more sophisticated markets of the world. Our involvement in developing countries has not been confined to India, as we have manufacturing programs in Taiwan, four large factories we're involved with there, South Korea, and now we have commenced operations in the People's Republic of China, to where I have made five or six visits in the last 18 months, and this week we have three of our key executives there launching a new manufacturing program. I believe the elements in our success to this point in time have been as a result of the following factors. First, our ability to negotiate carefully in the early stages in such a way that both parties have a clear picture of each other's aspirations. Two, our training programs have been adapted to local cultures and enable us to produce quality products at a relatively early stage, although our first experience it was a little longer time span. Tight quality control measures have also reduced the impact of potential disruption at a later stage to our supply networks. Our efforts to break down communication barriers, raised again by earlier speakers, by encouraging regular personal visits, have been supported by an approach where we encourage people to use carefully written communications, and more recently, particularly to China, regular direct telephonic conversation in Mandarin, so I wouldn't know what was going on. But however, those conversations take place almost daily and have done with a young man we employed who's doing a PhD in international business, works 3 days a week for us, and those 3 days a week he spends a lot of time on the telephone finding his way through the bureaucratic system. This action has ensured that we continue to monitor each party's aspirations and objectives, as well as all the relevant detail that goes with that. Fifthly, the company policies which protect our image in developing nations are such that they ensure we are a better than average employer, not only in rates of pay, but associated conditions of employment, a point again stressed earlier. And I think it's absolutely imperative that transnational corporations maintain a very high reputation in this area, employment conditions. And those who want a long-term future aim to be outstanding corporate citizens in any country in which they operate. Lastly, we spent considerable effort in challenging some unnecessary, and we've attempted to do this in India, some unnecessary bureaucratic controls and influenced changes which facilitated joint venture negotiations. In fact, my first visit to China was 5 years ago, and we've really only come to the end now. But we had enormous problem in the last 2 years, because some of the internal policies in China were just unworkable from our point of view. So we spent a lot of time in challenging those, not to be derogatory, because we wanted a long-term view, so we need to change some of the ground rules. And I believe that governments, when establishing new industrial policies, to those who represent governments of developing nations here, in order to attract foreign investment, should consult foreign industrialists. On the downside, I believe we failed to see the necessity to assist in the development of a strong infrastructure for our particular industry in which we're involved. I'm not talking of the general infrastructure, power, communication, but the ones that applied to our industry. We took it for granted that an industry, particularly in India, that an industry infrastructure would develop quickly without our close involvement. In hindsight, I consider that we should have spent time to encourage governments and private organisations to assist in the development of investment programs which support our activities in the region where we establish factories. Furthermore, a number of our management members failed to comprehend the long-term potential and commitment needed for successful offshore manufacturing and sourcing programs. Probably some of our executives had negative feelings about Asian people, or more than likely they were unsure because of their inexperience, and as a result communication between some individuals in a number of areas was less than satisfactory. In one market also, we failed to spend sufficient time in our discussions with government authorities in order to obtain feelings and other views in regard to political and economic aspirations of the company concerned. It is important to realise that transnational corporations should view return on investment over a longer period, the returns that they expect. They should take a longer time than is normally the case in Western countries, and leaders with long-term vision are essential if broad support in a company is to be obtained. You'll find many people objecting to the thrust by business leaders to go into difficult environments. There's so many, there are always people that are anti, so it does take leaders with vision within the transnational corporations. And they often need the support of people in developing nations to encourage them to fight the battles they've got to fight within their organisation to take a long-term view. Furthermore, technological transfer programs, to which the Senator referred, in industries which are not highly automated, require a great deal of additional executive effort, particularly in relation to training and quality control programs, particularly in the leather industry, where individual workers can have a great influence on the handwriting of the footwear. That's why the Italians are such great producers of footwear. They're all individual artists, and that's a factor in an area where you have a great deal of influence by the individual worker into the end result. So the training and quality control programs, as well as other areas of management, particularly production planning, a process which ensures timely delivery of goods, a serious area of weakness in many developing nations. I believe that political trade barriers are not necessarily the greatest constraint for developing nations, but rather their ability to develop an infrastructure and managerial skills capable of producing a consistent quality standard in accordance with predetermined delivery programs in whatever industry. And the textile industry, in its early stages of development in India, is a notable example, and it's really only in recent years that the deliveries from that source have been consistent and reliable, and certainly the quality is high. Anybody that visits the American stores and sees Indian garments $600, $700, $800, $900 could see that they've certainly made a crack of the quality market, and that's important that developing nations not get saddled just with lower quality articles and goods. They should also make an attempt to go for the higher quality end of the market that is capable of being sold to the most sophisticated customers in the Western world. It's very important. It is true that many developing nations have attempted to establish economic free trade zones with appropriate infrastructure, and obviously this has helped relieve some of the problems, but there is no substitute for very long-term consistent commitment by Western nations and the executives employed in them, particularly in the transnationals. And incidentally, a transnational doesn't need to be a large organisation. It can be a small organisation, somebody that has a small business. And I have friends in Australia who have also businesses in the Asian region, and they own the business and sole owners of the business. So transnational is somebody, as far as I'm concerned, that has a business in two nations. But there is no substitute for consistent commitment. That's the point I am emphasising, by people in the transnational corporation. Unfortunately, unless they have the vision, which is a point I made earlier, tenacity and dedication, many offshore programs in developing nations are placed in the two hard baskets of international companies, thus inhibiting the growth of third world country economies. So we've all got a battle to fight together. We're in it together, those that have a vision and believe that we want to develop our businesses in developing nations. On the other hand, many large corporations in the Western world which have not had substantial offshore investment programs, I see them now following the examples of companies like ours who have already developed strategic plans to restructure their organisation by sourcing raw materials, partly and totally finished products, from low labour cost countries, making their Western factories more assembly plants where reduced value-added components are produced, particularly those high labour cost components. I believe there will be a gradual but significant reduction in protection levels in Western countries, including Australia, particularly in the clothing and footwear sectors. By developing partnerships with Asian companies, for us anyway, we can provide a great deal of know-how, and that's been stressed earlier today in regard to wholesale marketing, designs, as well as managerial and technical know-how, which will enable products to be produced, which could be marketed throughout the world, even in developing nations themselves, where they have some need. A country like India, for example, probably has a demand in the type of high-grade footwear we produce larger than Australia, having 800 or 900 million people.